John Hanway, born October 23, 1924, in Mount Vernon, New York, served in World War II in the Army Air Corps, which became the Army Air Forces. Highest rank is First Lieutenant. This interview is being recorded on May 13, 2013, in Larchmont, New York. Interviewed by Jesse Kling, assisted by Jan Northrup. The interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, now a few preliminary questions. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was in the life insurance business. My mother was a school teacher.
Do you have siblings?
Yes.
How many?
Two living.
And are they brothers or sisters?
One brother, one sister. And a sister died at the age of 4 days, I think.
What were you doing before your enlistment?
I was in college.
Where were you in college?
Yale.
And do you have other family members who served in the military?
I think my brother was in the Navy for a while. This was after the war, though, not during World War II. I had a cousin who was in the Army, armored division in Europe. I don't know much about it. We were on opposite sides of the world and fighting in different wars, what it amounted to. And I didn't know him too well anyway. But that was all in the family.
So now getting to the actual interview questions, I guess. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
At the Hill School in Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
What was your reaction?
We're going to be at war. At that point, we all knew that sooner or later we were going to be in it, too. I was 17 at the time.
What was your reason for enlisting?
I was dodging the draft.
Why did you want to fight in this war? Did you want to fight in this war?
Everybody wanted to fight in the war at that time. You have no idea how strong the feeling was in the in the whole country. To give you an example, in September, when before Pearl Harbor, September, the Draft Act, which had been passed by Congress a year earlier, was up for renewal. It got renewed by one vote in the House of Representatives. It was that close. 3 months later, the country declared war on Japan, and the House of Representatives voted almost unanimously to support the declaration of war. That was how quickly the climate changed in the country. But you have no idea that the extent of the stay out of it across the center of the United States primarily. The two coasts were more likely to support the war effort, but in the middle of the country was isolationist until Pearl Harbor.
So why did you decide to join the Army Air Corps?
Because I wanted to fly.
So then what was your experience training like after enlisting?
I went to basic training for a month at Atlantic City. Then they sent us to college training detachments until they were ready to move us into the cadet training program. So I was at Bucknell Junior College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania for 2 months, but I spent 28 days of that 2 months in the contagious hospital with scarlet fever. And that was my first experience in flying. I'd never been in an airplane before. But they took us up in Piper Cubs, We didn't solo, but we flew a little with a civilian instructor. So by the time we got to primary flight school, we at least had been up in an airplane.
What would you say it was like to transition into military life?
Not difficult.
Could you talk about your experiences doing that?
I don't understand what you were told to do. You were in the Army. It was that simple. This was not so subject to discussion. You did what you were told.
Do you think you were adequately trained in learning how to fly each kind of plane that you had to fly?
I taught myself to fly two of the three planes that I flew. I really taught myself to fly three of them. Up through the training command, primary trainers, basic trainers, advanced trainers, training was good. Then they gave us fighters. You can't train anybody to fly a fighter because nobody's with you. You get in the cockpit, you learn what the things are in the cockpit and how they work, and then away you go. So my first transition was into the P-40, and then I think I had one or two days of P-40s. I got about 10 hours, and then they sent me to fly P-47s, Thunderbolts, and that was a big airplane, 7.5 tons fully loaded. 400-mile-an-hour fighter, 850-caliber machine guns. But you climbed into the cockpit, you learned how the cockpit worked, and then you took off and flew. And the same thing, I taught myself, I checked myself out in a P-38 down in New Guinea. I'd been sent overseas as a P-47 pilot, but I was stuck in a replacement unit down there. And because I had 5 hours or so in P-40s, I got a call to operations that said that we were told that I think there were 7 P-40s that they were going to ferry up to a little island called Morotai. And the P-40s that were going to go up there, we were told, were photo reconnaissance planes. They had cameras, no guns. And I thought, this is not for me, because first of all, I might get stuck in a reconnaissance outfit. That wasn't what I joined up to do. But I'd noticed on a bulletin board, when I walked into the operations hut, that the commanding general of 5th Fighter Command, I think it was 5th Fighter Command, it may have been the commanding general of the 5th Air Force, had said that any pilot, any single-engine pilot, who will volunteer to fly P-38s will be accepted immediately. I walked right over and said, I want to fly P-38s. And a sergeant who was checking us in said, you can't do that. You're going to fly a P-40. I said, the general says. So I got off the P-40 mission and reported down to operations to learn to fly a P-38. They had one, but they didn't have anybody there to fly it. So I took off a P-38 with a Lockheed Tech manual in my life, and the rest is history.
What was it like to fly a P-38 versus a P-40?
Well, I didn't, well, the P-40 was a good airplane, but it was obsolescent by that time. The primary fighters were in the Pacific, the P-38 and the P-47. In the European theater, the P-51 was ruling. That was the best fighter we had because it could fly all the way from the UK to Berlin and back. But we didn't get P-51s out in the Pacific until about... We didn't get them in any numbers until 1945. And prior to that, the P-38s were the primary fighters. We're the only ones who had the range.
What would you say, getting back to what life was like training at home in the U.S., what would you say life was like at military bases? What were your experiences like there?
I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I was in the Army. I did what I was told.
Like, what kinds of people did you meet and what kinds of activities did you do?
Well, the people that we were with, we were all pilots. So we had a daily routine. You'd fly a few hours, or you'd go to ground training of one kind or another. Everything was very well organized. After classification, when they decided whether you're going to be a pilot, a navigator, a bombardier, or you're going to be sent somewhere else, then you went to what they call pre-flight training at Maxwell Field, in my case, in Alabama, for 2 months. First month you were an underclassman, the second month you were an upperclassman. And you learned all the military stuff that they teach you when you're a plebe at West Point, but they jam it into you in 2 months. Then you go on to flight school. And flight school, primary flight school, you had civilian schools with civilian instructors. They taught us how to fly. And discipline was fairly lax because these were civilians. When we finished with our 2 months of primary training, and again, the first month you were an underclassman, second month you were an upperclassman. Then we went to basic flight training. And by that time we were flying BT-13s, as I remember. Basic training had about a 450-horsepower engine. The cockpit had a canopy over it. Your instructor sat in the rear and you sat in the front. It was a two-position prop, fixed landing gear, and you spent 2 months doing that, flying that. In the process, you learned to do some cross-country and some night flying. Then you moved up to an advanced. Now, at this point, there were two courses. If you're going to become a fighter pilot, they sent you to single-engine training. If you're going to become a bomber pilot or transporter, God knows what else, they sent you to a twin-engine training school. I went to single-engine. Went to Spence Field in Moultrie, Georgia. And there, the single-engine fighter trainer was the AT-6. And again, the first month you're an underclassman, the second month you're an upperclassman. When you graduate, you're commissioned a second lieutenant or appointed a flight officer. I think about 95% of us were graduated as second lieutenants, and you got your wings. And then you usually got a graduation leave of about 10 days. And then you were assigned to a fighter training camp someplace. If you'd graduated in the East as I did, it probably would have been in the 1st Air Force. I went to Camp Springs, which is right outside of Washington. It's now Andrews Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And then to Millville, New Jersey for advanced training in P-47s and gunnery practice, because we could fly out over the coast of Atlantic City and shoot up the fishes and so forth. And then you waited for an assignment. You got I broke an arm while I was there, so I got a 10-day sick leave because I couldn't fly. And my doctors had put me in a cast all the way up to my elbow for a broken finger. The first thing I did when I got back home, went home on sick leave to Pelham, went over to Fort Slocum. Did you remember Fort Slocum? Well, that was an Army base in those days. And I went in to see the Army doctor, and I showed him my arm, and I said, "Hey, Doc, look what the Navy did to me." He cut the cast off, put two pieces of tape around my finger, and I had 10 days sick leave at home, which I enjoyed very much in New York. But by the time I got back, my class had gotten ahead of me. I was left back. So the guys I'd been flying with went to Europe. I ended up in the Pacific.
So what exactly was your job as a fighter pilot?
To fly a fighter. You flew whatever missions you were asked to fly. The kinds of missions you flew were, by the time I got into it, would have been fighter sweeps to go ahead of a bomber attack, for example, and make sure there were no enemy aircraft around, or fighter sweeps for the purpose of attacking ground targets, aircraft, anti-aircraft, and so forth. Then escort missions with the bombers, and then later on, close support for infantry. We could carry either two canisters of napalm or two 1,000-pound demolition bombs. So we could dive bomb with the 1,000-pounders, or we could come in low and drop the napalm. And, of course, we had a lot of firepower in a P-38, 450 calibers and a 20-millimeter cannon, all firing out of the nose. So it's like a hose. And that made us a very good airplane to support the ground troops. So I had a lot of those missions.
What was your main concern while flying and how you would possibly be attacked?
You didn't worry about things like that. I'm serious.
Really?
You didn't worry about it. You just worried about what you were going to do and how you were going to do it.
But did you... So it never crossed your mind? That...
I was 20 years old. You don't worry about what might happen. You don't worry about it until it happens. I suppose that on bomber crews you had that problem that they would talk about it and think about it. Our main concern was what we were going to get to eat when we got back and whether the bar would still be open.
How much information did you get from intelligence in conducting your missions?
I don't know about that. I couldn't answer it. I assume that the group and the squadron commanders would be briefed, and we would be told only what we needed to know, which usually was not much of anything except what the course was to go out there and where we were going, and what the return course was. And about everything else was ad hoc.
So could you talk about, like, where exactly you served? Describe, like, the places that you served?
The best way to do that is give you this. This has the whole history on it. Mm-hmm. And then, once you turn the pages, you'll see every mission I flew is listed in there. Wow. And I think I've got dates and so forth.
Wow. Is this from your diary?
I can get, you know... All pilots kept logs. Mm-hmm. I didn't keep a diary, but I have my flight log.
Flight log.
But the rest of it I remember.
Wow. So I remember on the phone you were talking about how you engaged in missions in New Guinea and the southern Philippines?
I didn't fly combat in New Guinea. I was in a replacement unit down there waiting, and I did ferry missions and things like that. I started flying combat when I got to Leyte in the Philippines.
So what kinds of things did you do there?
Patrol missions, escort missions, and a lot of dive bombing and strafing missions, napalm missions. By the time I got into combat in the Philippines, we had air superiority over the Japanese. And by that time, the Japanese had changed their tactics. Japanese fighters were no longer engaging American fighters. They were using their planes as kamikazes. So it became essentially the Navy's problem.
Oh, so the Navy fighter pilots were the ones who went after the kamikaze plane.
Well, in most cases, because the kamikazes were attacking right. Naval shipping.
So they were going out aircraft. Right?
So, sure.
Yeah.
And we were, by that time, attacking Japanese concentrations on the ground and escorting bombers on long-range missions. I flew one or two missions all the way to China and back, escorting bombers.
And what was that for?
To protect the bombers in case Japanese fighters showed up.
And the bombers were going on missions?
To bomb installations in China or wherever. Up in Formosa. Usually it was B-24s that we covered. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever escorted a B-25 mission.
Did you ever run into a Japanese fighter plane?
Personally, no. I only saw one of them get shot down, and that was on a mission up to Formosa, and there were so many of us that it was no contest. I saw them in the air occasionally at a distance, but by the time I was in this, we had air superiority.
So your greatest fear, I mean, although you said you weren't afraid, would have been from anti-aircraft fire from the ground?
No, you got a lot of that.
And you got a lot of that.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that would have taken you down, though, would be the anti-aircraft fire from the ground.
Unless fighters showed up. But I was never on a mission that was attacked by Japanese fighters. But I one of the interesting missions, I'm not talking about an individual mission, but there was a pass on Luzon between the central plain of Luzon through the mountains up to the northern plain up in the Cagayan Valley. And that was known as Paliti Pass. The Japanese held both sides of Paliti Pass. And we'd go up over the top and go on up and carry out whatever mission we had. But I remember a couple of occasions when the weather was socked in, and the clouds were right down on top of the mountains. So instead of flying over the top, we went through Paliti Pass. And the Japanese were shooting at us from both sides. And I was laughing about it because we were going so fast that it was obvious the Nips weren't going to hit us. But they were like, they're shooting from opposite directions at each other, essentially. So we got a kick out of that.
So what did you witness during your missions? Is there any experiences that you'd like to talk about during?
Well, sometimes you're flying up there and all of a sudden you've got anti-aircraft all around you. Sometimes you're on an attack mission and against something on the ground and they're shooting back at you. Bellitti Pass is an example of one of the things. I remember one mission, we were flying up to Formosa. I was the element leader in the last flight, and I had a wingman who was a new pilot, new to the squadron, new to combat. I think it was probably his third or fourth mission. And we were going in to attack a Japanese, must have been a Japanese command post or something. And they briefed us with an aerial photograph the night before. And this building that we were going to hit was in a village that was right next to an airport, Japanese airbase. And the Japanese airbase was surrounded by anti-aircraft guns. So our squadron was going to come in from the sea, fly up to this town, make a 90-degree turn, and go in and bomb, dive bomb. And I was leading the last element of the last flight in the squadron. So when we made the right turn, my wingman and I would have been right over those anti-aircraft guns. So I told them, look, we're not going to do that. You stay with me and you go where I go, and we'll get through this. So as we flew in, I dropped lower and lower and lower. We were carrying 1,000-pound demolition bombs. We swung around using the town as cover between us and the guns, and we flew right up through the town, and we skip-bombed, which means we bounced the bombs, and they went like that. And we peeled off, and they never got a shot at us. Hmm. That was exciting.
So what emotions do you think going on combat missions brought out?
I don't remember anything special. You'd be told the night before if you were going to fly a mission. We'd go to bed. You didn't do much drinking the night before if you were going to fly a mission the next morning. You tied a towel around the end of your cot so that whoever was on duty to go around and wake up the pilots who had an early morning mission could find you without waking up everybody else in the tent. You got dressed, you had breakfast, you went down and got in your airplane, and away you went.
So it was a quite everyday task?
No, you didn't fly every day.
Like, just...
I flew 62 missions in about a 5 or 6 months period. We had more pilots than airplanes in the squadron. So, in the beginning, you flew whatever airplane was assigned to you. After you'd been around for a while, you got your own airplane. But on the days that you weren't flying, one of the newbies would be flying it. So, my first airplane, which I had inherited from a guy who went home, on a day when I wasn't flying it, one of the newbies took it up and never made it back. So I got a new airplane out of the deal.
What happened to him?
He got killed.
You mean that, was it anti-aircraft?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't on the mission.
Hmm. You just know him now, yeah.
He lost my airplane for me.
Yeah.
But I got a brand new one out of it. The first one was a P-38J-15, and the new one I got was a P-38L-5, and that was a beaut. It's a model of the kind of plane there on top of the piano.
Oh, wow.
That's our group commander's plane. And the P-47 is at the other end. That's what I was flying when I went overseas.
So I assume you witnessed some sort of combination of casualties and destruction during your missions, one way or another?
Well, you know, as a fighter pilot, you don't see casualties. Casualties happen to bomber crews. Bomber gunners get hit when the airplane is still flying. People can get killed on a bomber and the bomber is still going. With fighter pilots, it was different. If you got hit, you probably got killed. And if you didn't get hit, you survived. So, did I ever see anybody get shot down? Yes. But it was clean. And occasionally there'd be a mid-air collision and people would you'd lose them that way, but not too often.
How did seeing those kinds of things make you feel?
Thank God it was him and not me.
What kinds of friendships did you form during your service?
The people, we lived in tents, and usually there were four in a tent, four or five in a tent. Those were the guys that you were close to because you were with them 24/7. You didn't always fly on the same missions with them, but you were living the same routine life. So you got fairly close, but when the war ended, that was the end. I mean, I came from New York. I was flying with a P-38 group where almost all of the pilots came from places west of the Mississippi. And after the war, I think the only one I ever saw again was a guy who lived in Texas. Because I went down there, I was the first job I had after I got out of college. I was a traveling salesman down in that part of the world. That's where I met Elena. Met her Sunday night, married her Monday morning.
Oh my gosh.
We've been married for 63 years now.
In Texas?
Yeah. We got married in Nuevo Laredo. She lived in Laredo. And I knew I was never going to go back there again. Because it's about 100 miles from anywhere else, and in between it was nothing but cactus, rattlesnakes, white-faced cows, and roadrunners. Mm-hmm. It's a big town now. I think there are about 70,000 people back in 1940-something. It's on the main route from San Antonio down to Mexico. It's a big customs brokerage across the border. That's the main business of Laredo. And of course a market town for the ranches around.
Yeah.
So I met her. We skipped across the border to Nuevo Laredo, got married. I've never been back to Laredo since. She has, but I haven't.
She came back east with you then, once you got
married. Oh, well, what we did, she traveled with me for a while. Up until July. We got married in May, 8th of May. Then, because I was now married, they transferred me to Illinois. And we lived in Evanston in an apartment hotel. 85% of my customer base was in Chicago. So I was home almost every night. And then we moved back to New York. And we're here for a while, and then I left. I was working with Prince Machiavelli and Seaforth at the time, and I quit and became a management consultant for Robert Heller and Associates. We moved to Cleveland, lived in Fairview Park, and we were there for about 11 years, I guess. And then I joined ITT. Came back to New York. Stayed with ITT till I retired.
How did you keep in touch with loved ones when you were abroad?
rarely. Got a letter every now and then. Probably wrote maybe one every 3 or 4 months. I was always pretty much of a lone wolf. I'm the oldest one in the family. And there's a 4-year gap between my brother and me. We had a sister in between who died. I think she was in the first week of life. So my brother and sister are very close. But I was a loner. So I didn't worry much about that.